I am the MC this morning. I've got a little bit of a problem with my voice, so we're going to have to take, I've got water here and we'll see what I can do. But I want to introduce Judith, our dear, dear friend of Word and Life. We first found Judith in the fall of 2019 when we asked her to present her book. Her book is How to Live, What the Rule of Saint Benedict Teaches Us About Happiness, Meaning, and Community. So we spent 10 weeks on that book and it was a wonderful experience. So then we invited Judith to come back in 2021 when we were doing Michael Curry's book, Love is the Way. So both of those are on the website in the archives. So go back and look at those if you're interested. I sent out Judith's bio that you've all read. You've read about her journalism career and her presidency of the International Merton Society. So you read that yesterday or when I sent it out. But I wanted to add some different things. Judith leads a wonderful retreat pilgrimage every year to Italy. This year, she tells me she's going in August 29th to September 12th. So after we finish the breakout rooms, maybe we can ask her about that. And we were going to also ask her about recently, she was able to go to Dorothy Day's office or where the Catholic Worker was published and to enjoy the actual setting where Dorothy Day lived and where they had her memorial. Dorothy Day is certainly a woman of uncommon courage, and that's what we're looking at this time. The time is now. So with that, I would like to, let me see. I think I'll start with the prayer and then we can do our blessing, all right? An opening prayer. This is from Thomas Merton's The Thoughts in Solitude. My Lord God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think that I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. Therefore, I will trust you always. Though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death, I will not fear. For you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone. So with that, let's have Tim put on the blessing. And if you put your gallery view on, we can see each other. And we're going to hold up our hands and welcome Judith and bless her.
We bless you as you share your gifts of spirit, light, and insight. We welcome you with joy.
All right, Judith, you've been duly blessed.
Thank you for that beautiful blessing. It's always one of my favorite parts when I join you for these sessions. To add on to what Judith said, yes, I love the Word and Life community. In fact, one of my fondest memories of any place I ever spoke was to the Word and Life community when I was there in person in 2019. Everyone was so kind to me, Joel, Judith, Joe's wife, Mike. I don't know if Mike's here today, but Mike picked us up from the airport, and even people we met on the street were so friendly to us and kind. And I thought, everybody in Santa Barbara is so kind. It's wonderful. So thank you very, very much. I'm deeply honored to be here. A warm good morning to everyone. And as our Irish friends say, Caid Mila Fáilce, 100,000 welcomes. I'm very happy to be with you this morning to continue the discussion of The Time is Now, and how each of us can be a prophetic witness in our troubled and fragmented world. Because with every day that passes, the call for prophetic witness becomes increasingly more urgent. When Judith asked me to speak to you, this whole situation between Hamas and Israel wasn't even on the radar. And here we are today. So I'm going to now pull up some slides that I have to accompany my talk, which I hope will be an aid also for our reflection today. How's that, Tim?
Looking good.
Has that come up? Okay, thank you very kindly. All right, the time is now. And I'll be focusing on a few things, but zeroing in also on Thomas Merton's prophetic witness for crisis times. This is a famous photograph, as you know, taken from one of the Apollo missions of the Earth, taken from circling the moon. Our planet, the perspective of outer space, looks so tranquil, doesn't it? As if peace reigns in every corner of the planet. But here on the ground, our world seems to be experiencing these days a collective nervous breakdown. We just have to turn on the news to see the death and devastation engulfing Israel and the Palestinian territory. The world is still reeling from Russia's inhumane invasion of Ukraine as the world confronts a terrible, needless conflict as well in Yemen, where some 5,000 children have been killed. And this small wounded child lives there. And like most of the other children in Yemen, he is starving to death. There is as well the senseless genocide going on in Azerbaijan against ethnic Albanians. Why? For what? We can ask those questions about every single one of these wars. And it's not just the violence engulfing other parts of the world. There is senseless gun violence every single day in our own country. There are racial tensions that boil over time and again when an African-American citizen is killed by police. Add to that the worsening threat of climate change, the crisis of migrants seeking to settle in the US, and of course, our seemingly endless political divisions. As Pope Francis said on a recent visit to Marseille, France, our world today needs fraternity as much as it needs bread. Yes, reality does seem more surreal than real at the moment. What then is to be done? A question that Tolstoy often asked. What then is to be done? In her chapter on proclamation in The Time Is Now, Joan Chittister says it is not enough to say our prayers every day, or to go to church, or participate in liturgical rituals, important as those activities are. It's about what we do for what she calls the grubby and outcast, the forgotten and forsaken. The Spirit calling to each of us leads us on from grace to grace, Sister Joan writes, showing us life in all its struggles, prodding us to see the world through the eyes of God, requiring us to walk in the footsteps of the prophet Jesus. One such prophet who understood both proclamation and vision, the subjects of the two chapters I'm zeroing in on, is the Trappist monk Thomas Merton, whose witness I'd like to focus on this morning, because it speaks to us in so many ways. Merton could have spent his days happily removed from the turmoil of the world, tucked away in his monastery in the hills of Kentucky, writing lovely poetic texts on the spiritual life. But Merton lived in an age of war, in his case, the Vietnam War. He lived in a time of racial unrest, not unlike our own, when a deep chasm existed between life as it is and what Joan Chittister describes as life as God would want it to be. Merton decided that even though a monk's life is dedicated to prayer and contemplation, to seeking God alone, that he could not remain silent or detached from the travesties of the world. As Tim pointed out in last week's talk about Dorothy's Solid, contemplation leads to action. So Merton felt that he had to speak out. And at a certain point, this is a decision, a choice that we all have to make for ourselves. And it was a choice that cost Merton. He was denounced by many in the Catholic hierarchy and by even many of his fellow Catholics, including those who read his spirituality books and had turned him into a best-selling author. Many turned against him. And here's a cartoon that appeared in National Catholic Reporter, kind of lampooning this whole situation, in which you see a Catholic bishop on the left there in the black and a censor tearing out pages of Merton's writings, and Merton being placed in a waste paper basket that says, "Not Catholic enough." But Merton was determined not to remain silent, and for this we can be eternally grateful, because the words he wrote in the 1960s remain just as cogent and relevant today as when they were written. Now, you might ask, what caused Merton to turn toward the world? It can likely be traced to an experience he had on a rare visit outside of his monastery on a street corner in downtown Louisville at the intersection of 4th and Walnut Streets, now 4th and Muhammad Ali Street, a change reflecting the signs of the times. But as he stood at 4th and Walnut, watching the sea of humanity passing by, he experienced an epiphany, a prophetic epiphany. He would write later that day in his journal, "I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all these people, that they were mine and I was theirs, that we could not be alien to one another, even though we were total strangers." I'm pretty sure that passage is familiar to many of you because it's become known as Merton's 4th and Walnut Epiphany. And he goes on to describe the overwhelming impact this experience had on him. "It was like waking from a dream of separateness, of spurious self-isolation, in a special world, the world of renunciation and supposed holiness." The important thing here is that something significant changed in Merton's worldview. He had thought of monks as people living at the margins of society. Now he grasped that even a monk living separately from the many distractions and attachments of the world was still in the world, and indeed had a responsibility to speak to the world. In fact, by living on the margins, he reasoned that a monk could see more clearly, speak more accurately of what is taking place in the world. As he wrote later in his book, contemplation in a world of action. I am simply the voice of a self-questioning human person who struggles to cope with turbulent, mysterious, demanding, exciting, frustrating, confused existence in which almost everything public is patently phony. Now, those of us who witnessed these past few years of so-called alternative facts and attempts to replace objective reality by some with false narratives, we know all too well what Merton is identifying here. It was after his epiphany on 4th and Walnut that Merton began speaking out against the proliferation of nuclear weapons, the oppression of indigenous people around the world, and most certainly one of the most pressing issues of his day, the lack of basic civil rights for African Americans here in our country. In a critique of society that could have been composed today, Merton wrote in August 1960 to his friend, the social activist and Catholic Worker founder, Dorothy Day, "We have lost our sense of values and vision. We love fatness, health-bursting smiles, the radiance of satisfied bodies, all properly fed and rested and sated and washed and perfumed and sexually relieved. Anything else is a horror and scandal to us. How sad, for I am part of the society which has these illusions, and I can't help sharing its guilt, its illusions." At these words of Merton's, I can't help but think of the armed protesters that showed up at state capitals during the height of the COVID pandemic, demanding that businesses reopen to move the economy forward, despite the fact that thousands of workers were dying every day of the virus. In words that seem as valid today as in 1963 when he wrote them, Merton offered this critique of our consumeristic, materialistic, capitalistic society. When we call ourselves the free world, we mean, first of all, a world in which business is free, and the freedom of the person comes only after that. It is not the life of the spirit that is real to us, but the vitality of the market. We see this still in debates today over whether to increase the minimum wage or raise taxes on corporations or the wealthiest 1% of Americans. Merton also understood our human propensity to seek out enemies and create false narratives about the quote-unquote other. We see this today in how some in our country talk about refugees and immigrants and asylum seekers coming to our southern border. In his book, No Man is an Island, Merton writes, "Violence rests on the assumption that the enemy and I are entirely different. The enemy is evil, and I am good. The enemy must be destroyed, and I saved. But love sees things differently. It sees that even the enemy suffers from the same sorrows and limitations that I do. Death is the same for both of us, and war is both his enemy and mine." Gosh, I can't look at the images coming out of Gaza these days without thinking of what Merton's wisdom is in saying that. Like Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and Catholic Worker founder Dorothy Day, Merton came to believe that nonviolence is the only rational answer to resolving conflict. And he expresses these thoughts in a famous essay called The Root of War is Fear, found at the end of his book, New Seeds of Contemplation. But some of the most powerful writing that Merton did on race, war, peace, and nonviolence is actually found in his poetry. And he wrote thousands of poems. His collected poems is a book about that thick. It's about 500 pages. In his poems, Merton masterfully lays out the futility and the absurdity of the violence we perpetrate on one another. And these poems, I think, again, take on even more resonance given the horrors that we're seeing today over in Gaza. So let's take a look at some of these poems, if you will. One of Merton's most famous and powerful anti-war poems is chanted in processions around a site with furnaces. Maybe some of you have read it or seen it. It's quite famous. It is written ostensibly in the voice of the commandant at Auschwitz, Rudolf Hess. And Merton uses quotes from official documents and transcripts of the trials of Nazi war criminals in the poem. So using actual official language, actual things that human beings have said, gives the poem its immense emotional power. In chant to be used in processions, Merton wanted to show the banality of evil, something Joan Chittister talks about in The Time Is Now. What would make otherwise ordinary human beings engage in monumental acts of inhumanity, such as the Nazi death camps? And we might ask the same question about what is happening in the Gaza Strip today. Merton says it is when we let go of our humanity that such things happen. And it was Dorothy Day who published this poem in her Catholic Worker newspaper in October 1961. So here's the start of the poem. I'm going to put that on the next screen. But I just want to say, please listen for how nonchalantly the speaker in the poem talks about things like Zyklon B, the chemical used to kill camp inmates, and how the speaker euphemistically describes the gas chambers as cleaning appointments and a place where people are sent to simply sleep. Chant to be used in processions around a site with furnaces. How we made them sleep and purified them, how I commanded. I made cleaning appointments, and then I made the travelers sleep. And after that, I made soap. I was born into a Catholic family, but as these people were not going to need a priest, I did not become a priest. I installed a perfectly good machine. It gave satisfaction to many. When the trains arrived, the soiled passengers received appointments for fun in the bathroom. They did not guess. They would be given a greeting card to send home, taken care of with good jobs, wishing you could come to our joke. Another improvement I made was I built the chambers for 2,000 invitations at a time. The naked votaries were disinfected with Zyklon B. Children of tender age were always invited by reason of their youth. They were unable to work. They were marked out for play. They were washed like the others and more than the others. Merton uses a similar technique to great effect in another of his famous anti-war poems called Original Child Bomb. It is a prose poem whose words are lifted almost entirely from historical documents describing the dropping of the first atomic bomb. The poem is very long, much too long to recite here, so I'll just quote an excerpt. Throughout the poem, Merton deftly shows how the language of war corrupts and distorts ordinary human speech. The title of the poem comes from the name the Japanese gave the first atomic explosion, child bomb. The Japanese sensed all too well that on August 6, 1945, human history had given birth to an irrevocable evil, and that the original child bomb would likely generate more offspring over the course of history. The very scientists handling the bomb referred to it as little boy. The military reverted to religious imagery, codenaming the testing site for the A-bomb in New Mexico, Trinity. The radio call signal for the aircraft that carried the bomb to Hiroshima was Dimples. And Tinian Island, the launching pad for the atomic attacks on Japan, was codenamed, if you can believe this, Papacy. I mean, you cannot make this stuff up. It is from the actual historical documents. And the poem ends with these powerful lines. The men in the plane perceived that the raid had been successful, but then they thought of the people in the city, and they were not perfectly happy. Some felt they had done wrong, but in any case, they obeyed orders. It was war. I'd like to turn now to another crisis that was unfolding in Merton's time and continues to perplex us even today, the issue of race. After George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, igniting the Black Lives Matter movement, I began reading for the first time a series of essays Merton wrote in 1963 called Letters to a White Liberal. Letters to a White Liberal. Now, while our country has undoubtedly made progress on race since then, I couldn't help thinking, reading these essays, that here we are, you know, in 2020, 2021, 2022, 2023, grappling with so many of the same challenges. Merton recognized 60 years ago that racial injustice cannot be mitigated by laws alone. It is a collective spiritual matter to be solved in the hearts of individuals. Merton said racism is not a burden to be borne and eradicated solely by people of color. It is a cancer eating away at the souls of white people. And he wrote, "The cancer of injustice and hate, which is eating white society, is rooted in the heart of the white man himself." Now, if you can forgive the outmoded masculine language that Merton uses, it was, after all, the language of his times, he actually makes a number of relevant points. Here is a passage of his that helped me understand some of the struggles of the summer of 2020, in which violence broke out in many of our cities after George Floyd's death. "The Black person finally gets tired of this treatment and becomes rightly convinced that the only way he is ever going to get his rights is by fighting for them himself. We warn him against violence and even in some cases provoke it in the hope that the whole movement for freedom can be repressed by force." And he adds, "It is curious that the ones who repeatedly lecture the Black community on law and order themselves are often in league with murderers and thugs. Pretty darn powerful stuff. But the thing to remember is that Merton saw struggles with race as a potential moment of grace for people of faith. Therefore, an important question to ask ourselves, Merton says, is not what is going to happen in our country, but what are we going to do? Otherwise, he says, the moment of grace will pass without effect. Now, the question of race became personal for Merton. In April of 1968, Merton wrote a personal letter, as you see here, to Coretta Scott King the day after Dr. King was shot. And here's an image of that letter from the archives of the Merton Center at Bellarmine University in Louisville. It was the assassination of Martin Luther King was a particularly painful shock for Merton. He had been working that very month to arrange for Dr. King to come to his abbey, the Abbey of Gethsemane outside of Louisville, to go on a retreat. King postponed the visit to Gethsemane and went instead to Memphis to intervene in a garbage worker strike. And that is, of course, where he was shot. Merton and King would never meet. Merton himself, just 9 months later, would die in an accident in December 1968 while on a visit to Bangkok. He was accidentally electrocuted when he tried to plug in a fan in his room in Bangkok after coming out of a shower. Here's the poem Merton wrote after the King assassination, based on news reports he had seen in the days following the shooting. Notice how certain phrases are repeated throughout the poem, and that the poem is written kind of like a psalm. The poem's called April 4th, 1968. On a rainy night in April, when everybody ran, said the minister, on a balcony of a hotel in Tennessee, we came upstairs at once. On a rainy night in April, when the shot was fired, said the minister, we came at once upstairs and found him lying after the tornado on the balcony. We came at once upstairs. On a rainy night, he was our hope, and we found a tornado, said the minister. And a well-dressed man, said the minister, dropped the telescopic storm. And he ran, the well-dressed minister of death. He ran away. And on the balcony, said the minister, we found everybody dying. It's moving to me that this was also one of the final poems Merton wrote before his own death. It drives home the point that when one of us dies unjustly, tragically, we all suffer death. I want to turn now to what is perhaps Merton's most enduring prophetic message for our crisis times. As much as he believed we have a responsibility to read the signs of the times we live in and respond to the urgencies of those times, he understood that change is an interior process, one that begins in the depths of the heart. He understood too, and this is so relevant to many of the crises we are facing today in our country, he understood that if we try to fix what lies outside of us, we also need to do the necessary work to address the disorders within our own hearts. he distills this idea in one of my favorite passages of his, again from his essay, "The Root of War is Fear." I'm coming to the end here now. "Instead of hating the people you think are war makers, hate the appetites and disorders in your own soul, which are the causes of war. If you love peace, then hate injustice, hate tyranny, hate greed, but hate these things in yourself, not in another." In the final analysis, Merton believed a life of prayer, a life of contemplation and compassion, an esteem for silence, furnishes us with the interior wherewithal to live a prophetic life, a life free from useless care, and a life free from fear, the root of war. It comes back almost full circle to that epiphany he had on the corner of 4th and Nuts in downtown Louisville. That day, he seemed to see in each of the persons passing before him a quote unquote, another Christ. And he wrote later that day in his journal, "It was as if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts. If only they could all see themselves as they really are. If only we could see each other that way all the time, there would be no more war, no more hatred, no more cruelty, no more greed. But there is no way of telling people that they are all walking around shining like the sun." This is the gift of wisdom and compassion Merton tried mightily to impart. It is the gift we are all called to share as prophets in our wounded, fragmented, and fragile world. Thank you for your kind attention this morning, and thanks be to God. Let us take a moment of silence to reflect on what we heard, some of the images we saw, and then I'll put up some questions on the screen as a springboard for our discussion. So Tim, do you want to take it away?
Sure. Why don't you read these questions, and I just put them in the chat, and we'll send people off to reflection groups.
Yeah, I put three up, whichever one maybe appeals to you more than another. In what way did Thomas Merton's perspective on conflict, nonviolence, race relations, and modern society cause you to pause this morning and perhaps see something in a new light? How can we help lead the world beyond the darkness of its present divisions? That's a question Joan Chittister asks, and the time is now. And how can we remind people of their own innate goodness and that we are all walking around shining like the sun?
Wonderful. Thank you, Judith.
I'll stop. All right, friends.
Yeah, there you go. We'll have about, I think, 25 minutes or so for conversation. We'll come back around 11:10. Remember, you'll be randomly assigned by the Zoom algorithm to a group of 3 to 4 folks. If you find yourself in a small group, I will move you fairly quickly over to a larger group to make sure that you have enough folks to dialogue with. And yeah, we look forward to the conversation and to seeing you back here in just a little bit. Here we go. Okay, looks like everyone is back together. We've got about 20 minutes for some closing conversation with Judith. If you want to raise your hand digitally or try to do it where we can see you or type a question in the chat, there's multiple ways to submit something. And Judith, as always, if you have any opening comments, you're welcome to make them. If not, we'll just start going with the questions. So. Okay, I see Judy McDermott with the hand up. So
yeah, another Judith here. By the way, both of our mothers called us Judith, but then we were Judy when we were growing up. At any rate, one of the questions had to do with what can we do? And I just asked a person in our breakout room if he would tell his suggestion, because I think it's practical and I think people don't even think about it. So Joe, would you tell everybody what you told us? You have to unmute.
Well, this isn't, I can't take credit for this. This came from one of the prophets in our small group last week, who I've been told I shouldn't name. I shouldn't give her credit. But she mentioned that one of the things, a simple thing she did, was in recognizing that there are people hurting and trying to be, you know, attentive recognizing of other people and their issues, was the checkers in the grocery stores, okay? And how they're getting their hours cut and they're getting reduced to part-time, losing benefits and all that stuff. And she said a simple thing that she's been doing is, instead of doing the automatic checkout, to go through the line and, you know, maybe even say something nice to the checker, you know, to make their day go a little better. You know, that's a really simple thing, but it just stuck with me as a great example, because we say, you know, what can we do to solve the world's problems? But that's a place to start.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Joe.
Yeah, Barbara, why don't you unmute and go ahead? Just make sure you unmute, Barbara. We can't hear you yet.
I do now. Am I unmuted?
Okay. Barbara Berger.
Barbara Larson or Barbara Berger, do you want to talk first?
Okay. It really starts from our own hearts, and it has to start from there. And I also like Merton's quote that says, we are all walking around shining like the sun. And if we could all be like an ascended being, like light as we are, beautiful and loving, I know that's a lot to ask, but just if we could start thinking of ourselves as being more elevated and enlightened and wanting to give love to the people we see and meet every day. That's my input.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Barbara Larson, do you want to go too?
Yeah, sure. Well, Barbara Berger was in my group. And Barbara, that's just beautiful. And all I was going to say was, in the group, we did dig deeper, and we were, and this came out of really talk about the Gaza-Israeli situation and how that all started, you know, years ago with the Balfour Declaration in 1948, all you know. And then how the United States would not take in Jewish refugees, or really limited the number when lifted the quota. And so we got onto prejudice in our own families, and how as little kids during World War II, we heard anti-Jewish slurs by our parents. And the idea that perhaps, at least in white society, attitudes toward the other, whatever race, little tiny kids hear these remarks, and that's how it's passed on. But the antidote, I know, is what Barbara Berger, who was in our group. Say it again, Barbara. That's so beautiful.
Oh, about it has to start from our own hearts.
Yes.
And I just really like that whole idea. If we could all see each other walking around shining like the sun. I love that's a Merton quote. But if we could be shown as, you know, much more elevated in our thinking and our hearts and our love, and it would just make a whole difference to all the people around us. They would reflect it too, I'm sure.
Ann, Ann Heck, you were in our group. Did you want to talk about, we had an interesting discussion about how the human race has always had wars and conflicts and racial discord. And Ann, you know, I thought what you said was very about having lived through difficult times, you know, being of a certain age of having lived through difficult times, what to do.
Mm-hmm. I just commented on the fact that most of us are of an age when we have seen us go through difficult times. We remember the assassination of Martin Luther King. We remember the fight, you know, the dreadful summer of 1968 with the assassinations and the chaos of the Democratic National Convention and all of the troubles of that time. And we got through it. So the fact that that should give us some perspective on what is happening in the world is not new, and we do survive it. And then we, you know, having done that and known that, we should be less fearful than the young people who are I'm worrying about the young people right now because they seem so depressed and having a hard time. And I think we can give them perspective and help them and help anyone who is feeling traumatized by what's going on, just by our steadfastness and insisting that we will get through this. And we have resources that helped us to get through. And certainly we can bring in all of our spiritual practices and all of that, but we will. Mm-hmm. So take advantage of our perspective as older people.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah. I saw David, did you have a hand up? And then I see Jackie after that.
Ann said it much better than I could. I was going to give an incomplete thought and she finished the thought, which is great. So now the first half of that was all I was going to have. And that is, having struggled with anxiety for a number of years, I've found that how I feel inside doesn't have much to do with the external events of the world. It has a lot more to do with what I tell myself about the external events of the world. Mm-hmm. And what Ann said, I found, wow, that is just great. You're right, that historical perspective. So thank you.
Yeah, I'm giving a retreat this weekend. You all are reminding me of our topic, which is essentially based around how do we connect with everyday beauty in response to the philosopher Blaise Pascal's comment that in difficult times, we always need to hold something beautiful in our heart. You know, and how do we reorient to beauty so that it can be a grounding impulse for us in the midst of suffering and global catastrophe? But yeah, Jackie, why don't you unmute and go ahead?
Tim, I wonder, you probably do know of this book, but speaking of beauty, and I so agree with you that pay attention to the small beauties. Have you read John O'Donohue's book on beauty?
The Invisible Embrace, indeed.
It's an amazing way of looking at things. But I was also thinking, yes, we've seen so much. My gosh, I'm way into my 90s by now and seeing these things go on and on, and having taught biblical history for a long time, know that it's been a 4,000-year conflict for that little strip of land. But I'm thinking, too, we see them come, we see them go, but what have we learned? Each generation, as it's born, seems to pick up that same Stone Age mindset almost of vengeance. He did it first, so I'm going to strike back. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Anne, why don't you go ahead and unmute?
You know, the quote from Merton about there's no way to of letting people see that they're all shining in the sun. Maybe it's something that we could take. How can you let other people see themselves as shining in the sun? And so maybe that's part of that is appreciating people. And, you know, the United States has this reputation for being a worldwide leader, but we haven't cleaned up our own act. And Merton also says that you have to fix what's inside of you first. Mm-hmm. And so, like, we can't really, I mean, I'm not going to go over to the Middle East and make a difference, but can I make a difference here? Maybe just in the people that I'm talking with, or maybe somebody that I see, like somebody mentioned the checkers in the store. Mm-hmm. If we as Americans could develop a habit of staying and doing nice things for each other. And, you know, I think that a lot of reason that people are depressed is social media. Because sometimes when I just sort of sit around, I'm kind of bored and I watch Facebook, I don't always like what I'm seeing. And I realize it kind of makes me feel sick. Could we somehow change those things? Occasionally you see stuff where people put out good stuff, you know, cute flowers and cute puppies and stuff like that. But could we, I don't know, could we think of good things to drop in there for the young people? Because what are they learning? They're learning kind of a lot of not very nice stuff. So how are we going to do that as a society? And we may as well use the things we've got, the tools, which might be Facebook or Instagram or whatever. Anyway, thank you. That's my piece.
Yeah, I think one thing that we talked about also in our group was a favorite phrase of Mary Oliver's, put yourself in the way of grace. Mm-hmm. Where do you find grace in these times? And how do you spread grace in these times? Because I think we're also going to get through it only through the grace of God, since there's only so much we can do in our human capacity.
Pat, make sure you unmute, and then we'll go Marie after that. There you go.
Several little unmutes on my screen. Which one will work? First, many thanks to Judith. We've been looking forward to this morning, and you have not disappointed. You brought so much richness into our thought streams. But I'd be grateful if you could comment just a little about the role of nonviolence. It's a very powerful thing, literally something that we can activate, I suspect, but it's also a big topic that is somehow hard for us to get a grip on. Just any comments you could give us.
Yeah, it is a big topic. And, you know, there's a nonviolence we can practice in our little lives, and then there's the nonviolence on a global scale. Mm-hmm. The nonviolence on the global scale is what people like Dorothy Day, Merton, and peace activist Eileen Egan, they came to the conclusion that there is no just war in the age of nuclear weapons. So we've just got to somehow stop war when it begins. Okay. So, I mean, I think you see that people demanding a ceasefire right now.
Yes.
Pause, you know, the bombing's got to stop. Okay. So that's nonviolence on a global level. But what is nonviolence in a personal level, a very individual level? Well, there's a beautiful scene, a couple things I'll say. There's a beautiful scene in the film To Kill a Mockingbird, where these men who are obviously racists are trying to get into a fight with the main character who's played by Gregory Peck in the movie. Mm-hmm. And one of the guys gets right up in Gregory Peck's face. And you see Gregory Peck's little kids in the car looking about what is their father going to do? You know, is he going to punch the guy in the mouth? Is the other guy going to punch their father in the mouth? And in fact, the guy who has the issue over race spits in Gregory Peck's face. Mm. And then you see Gregory Peck raise his hand. What's he going to do? He takes a handkerchief out of his pocket. You may remember the scene. He wipes the spit off his face, puts the handkerchief back, stares at the guy, turns around and walks away. Okay, he was practicing nonviolence. And it's, you might call it way. The third way is, I think, what peace activists actually call that kind of thing, where you do not engage in the fight. And I have a situation in my family where one of my oldest cousins, whom I love dearly, you know, was just saying things at a lunch we had together the other day, which I was completely appalled by. I mean, his political views, which I sort of suspected, but I had not heard in full before. Mm-hmm. And I love my cousin. I love him. He's a good person. He's involved in the Elks and the this and the that, you know, this and that charitable organization. And so now I'm struggling with what is a loving way for me to tell him I love him, but I wish his perspective were different. And so I think that's nonviolence too. I mean, mm-hmm. violence would be just cutting him out of my life. Which I had to do with a family member who was just so racist. You know, I just said, you please don't email me, don't call me, don't send me things anymore. We're just on different planets. But I don't want to do this with this particular cousin. So I think that was practicing maybe the third way, you know. Mm. I don't know, Pat Patricia, if that helps.
It's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. Mm. There was somebody else I know.
Yeah, Marie, would you like to unmute and go ahead?
Well, do we have time?
This will be our last one, but yeah, we do.
I'll be quick. I just remember traveling to Japan and going to a museum about Hiroshima. And I was feeling such trepidation. What in the world would be the Japanese viewpoint about Hiroshima? And I was stunned at how neutral this museum was. And, you know, there was nothing about hatred or anger or reprisal, nothing about that. I found that just amazing that the Japanese people could move on from the terrible destruction we had imposed on them. So that's just another example of nonviolence. And I've read it today or recently. Do not answer evil with evil. And that's sort of where we are right now in the Middle East. We cannot answer evil with evil.
Thank you. Jackie, did you have a final comment to make?
Yeah, I just wanted to say I also went to Hiroshima. That's the way they pronounce it over there anyway. And our guide said, we bear you no ill will for this because we feel that the war would have gone on much longer if you hadn't dropped the bomb. I was so impressed with that. I was in tears after seeing the museum. They made no comment on what happened, but they just showed the pictures of it. And I couldn't ever feel that we had any right to drop a bomb no matter what. But they have found their own way to absorb this and to to live with it and to forgive. So can we do less?
All right, Judith, you want to bring us home?
Bring us home. All right. Now, we wanted to talk a little bit about, or I wanted Judith to talk a little bit about her visit to Dorothy Day's and about her the pilgrimage that she leads in Italy. So, Judith, will you send me some information? I'll put it on the resource page.
Yeah, I'll send you something I wrote about my visit to Dorothy Day's room. It was actually her room, which was so tiny, you know? I mean, you wouldn't believe what a tiny room she lived in. And she had one little window that she would look out of. But, you know, the Catholic Worker is certainly, I went to the New York Catholic Worker for the first time. I've been to other Catholic Workers around the country. Catholic Worker houses of hospitality. But, you know, to be in Dorothy Day's room was quite a spiritual experience. Mm-hmm. And that's nonviolent. I mean, what they do there is practice nonviolence.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could call it the works of mercy, but it's also the works of nonviolence. So mm-hmm. I'll send you a little something that I wrote on that. And I'll send you a little description of our, we call it a contemplative cultural culinary retreat pilgrimage to little known Italy.
Little towns in Italy. Well, thank you so much, Judith. We really appreciate it. I'm going to close us off by saying that next week we have Reverend Sarah Thomas coming from Trinity Church here in Santa Barbara. So we'll see you then. But right now I want to close us off with a prayer. This is Thomas Mertens from Nonviolent Alternative. How timely to close with this. Thomas says, grant us prudence in proportion to our power. Wisdom in proportion to our science, and humaneness in proportion to our wealth and might. Bless our earnest will to help all races and people to travel in friendship along the road to justice, liberty, and lasting peace. Grant us, above all, to see that our ways are not necessarily your ways, that we cannot fully penetrate the mystery of your designs. O God of holiness, merciful to all, grant us to seek peace where it is truly found, in your will. O God, is our peace. With that, thank you so much, Judith. And let's open up by taking off take mute off and say, goodbye and thank you, and we'll see you all next week. All right.
Bye.
Thank you, Judith.
Bye.
Thank you, Judith.
Thank you. You're quite welcome. Thank you.
We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Thanks, bye. Judith. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Take care, everybody. Take care of yourselves. All of you who are ill.
Yeah. I'm better now. Look at you. You cute me.
All right. Take care, everybody.
Be well, all.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.